I seem to have prepared quite a lot for today, so we'll see where we get to, hopefully to the end. I want to talk about black hole thermodynamics today. It carries on very naturally from the discussion that we were having yesterday when we talked about boundary in boundary terms. So at the end of yesterday, we got to the point where we had added a piece to the Einstein-Hilbert action so that when we did the variational principle, we actually got a well-defined process. All we ever did was set delta G to zero on the boundary, and this extra boundary integral cancelled off the normal derivatives of G that we found when we just did the variational principle on the Einstein-Hilbert action. So I think I forgot to give a name to that boundary term, which is, of course, Gibbons-Hawking, because Gibbons and Hawking were the guys who actually went through this back in the late 70s. So the reason they were exploring this process was that they were looking at an alternative formulation for black hole thermodynamics. So initially, this notion of black holes having some sort of thermodynamical properties was evolved by thinking about thermodynamics in the universe as a whole and thinking about what happened when matter fell into a black hole. So normally in a thermodynamical process, entropy increases, but this idea of a black hole being a sort of universal vacuum cleaner seemed to contradict that unless you assigned an entropy to the black hole, which was what Bekenstein did. And then if you assign an entropy to the black hole and the black hole is a black, some sort of black body, then does the black hole radiate? And that was what was demonstrated by Hawking in 74 when he did his calculation of field theory on the background of a Lorentzian black hole. But later that decade, Gibbons and Hawking, you know, were trying to look at Euclidean approaches to gravity, so moving towards quantum gravity, sort of, you know, in doing some steps of quantum gravity. And they sort of said, well, let's use this partition function approach. Let's see if we can define thermodynamics in a more abstract way, rather than having to sort of roll your sleeves up and do quite a hefty QFT calculation. And so they spotted this business with the Einstein-Hilbert action being degenerate over a wide range of solutions and realized that the term that you were neglecting on the boundary was the problem and found this boundary term. So let's see what they did in applying it to our black hole. So remember, we looked at the Euclidean Schwarzschild solution and found that we could make it regular provided we identified our Euclidean time with a characteristic periodicity, delta tau, was 8 pi gm. So this was associated with the inverse temperature of the black hole. So now let's see if we can use this manifold, this Euclidean manifold, and do a calculation, a partition function type of calculation, by evaluating the action. So the first thing I want to do is to demonstrate that the Euclidean action of the Schwarzschild black hole is, first of all, not zero, and secondly, not degenerate. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to consider a process in which I truncate my Euclidean geometry at some finite but large radius, capital R. I'm going to calculate this action on this truncated geometry and then take the limit as capital R tends to infinity. So my boundary is now an S2 cross S1, So here, this is delta M. And the S2 has radius capital R, and the S1 has radius 1 minus 2gm on R, or size 1 minus 2gm on R. So our normal is radial, and it's, if we want to normalize it such that it's a unit normal, I have to multiply by square root of 1 minus 2gm on R. So that's my unit normal. And so now I know everything that I need in order to calculate the extrinsic curvature. So the extrinsic curvature K is simply the divergence of this normal vector field. And so the divergence of a vector field is just 1 over root G d mu root G times the vector field. So I differentiate r squared nr, and I evaluate it at the boundary, which is at capital R. So that should be a capital R here. So that's my extrinsic curvature. So if I ask what is my boundary term, I have to integrate k root h over the boundary. Well, k root h is just this combination. Now, the determinant of the metric on the boundary is r squared sine theta times the square root of 1 minus 2gm on r. So that gives me a factor of r squared root 1 minus 2gm on r times this, and then the sine theta, I'm integrating with respect to d theta, d phi, d tau, just gives me 4 pi beta. So if you notice here, this first piece, first term, is dependent on R, and it's actually equal to 2r minus 3gm when I multiply k through by r squared, the square root of 1 minus 2gm on r. So it's not zero, but unfortunately, it's divergent as r tends to infinity. So we've kind of been too successful now. However, it would be divergent even if I set the mass to zero. In other words, I would get a divergent answer for flat space. So obviously, we don't want to have a divergent answer for our vacuum. We'd like to have zero. So that means we compute our boundary term for the vacuum for flat space and subtract it from this term here. So what we're going to do instead is to subtract off the flat space extrinsic curvature from our sort of bare extrinsic curvature, and then we'll do the integral. So our bare extrinsic curvature was 2 over r, root 1 minus 2gm on r. Plus a gm on r squared piece. And then my flat space extrinsic curvature is just 2 over r. So if I expand here at large r, I get 2 over r into 1 minus gm on r plus gm on r squared plus order 1 on r cubed terms. So now my 2 over r piece cancels with the 2 over r piece from the bare extrinsic curvature, and what I end up with is minus gm on r squared. So putting this into my action, I've got a 4 pi beta for my integral. Then I've got r squared times this minus gm on r squared. So I get minus gm plus higher order pieces that go to 0 as r tends to infinity. So I end up with my action, which is the same as the boundary term, being a half beta m. So that's now finite, and it's also non-degenerate. If I change the mass of my black hole, I change the action. So now I want to try and see what this tells me about the thermodynamics of the black hole. So normally, if we wanted to think about our partition function at finite temperature, we'd take a trace over states of e to the minus beta h, where our h would be sort of our Hamiltonian. Which, I'm just crudely speaking, is like our action. So beta H is essentially our Euclidean action. So here, I've calculated that. So for Schwarzschild, the saddle point term, it's going to look something like e to the minus beta m on 2. So my temperature, I already argued, that T was 1 over beta, which was 1 over 8 pi gm. But then from this approach, entropy S is given by a derivative with respect to beta of the partition function . But if I take log z, I just get minus beta m on 2. So my entropy is just proportional to a derivative of the mass with respect to beta. But beta was 8 pi gm. So my entropy should be 8 pi g times beta squared on 2, sorry, beta squared on 2 times 8 pi g, which is then 4 pi g m squared, replacing beta as 8 pi g m. And I can rewrite that as 2gm squared divided by g, 4 pi times 2gm squared divided by 4g, which is 4 pi times 2gm squared divided by 4g, the area of the black hole horizon divided by 4g. So from this approach, which is somewhat formal, we get the fact that the entropy of our black hole is proportional to its area. So at this point, we now see how it's possible for black holes to be perfectly consistent thermodynamical objects, because if we have matter and we throw it into the black hole, then the area of our black hole increases, and therefore its entropy increases. And since our constant here is g, which is the setting the Planck is the Planck scale, that means that in fact this is the maximal amount of entropy we could possibly imagine, because our sort of counting of states here is given by sort of a Planck unit. So that's one way of finding black hole thermodynamics. So I'd like to now do a somewhat different approach, which is a little more basic. It's a bit more empirical, but it's perhaps a little easier to see. So you'll see this is a sort of approach from a pseudo-Euclidean quantum gravity, and there are various ways in which you could be unhappy with it. So let's look at a different way of doing it. So this is my Kerr black hole. We've already looked at this last week and sort of thought a little bit about it as a physical black hole. So what I want to do now is to think about it with a little bit more of an eye on the sort of quantum properties of the black hole in a very loose sense. And I want to try and argue, sort of say, well, if we take this intuition over here of the entropy being the area and the temperature being a sort of Euclidean periodicity, what do I get as my entropy and temperature for the Kerr black hole? Well, for the area of the event horizon, I look at this second line here, and I basically set delta to zero, so I ignore the top line. And I can see that I've got a sine squared theta again. The sigmas kind of cancel, and then I've got this r squared plus a squared piece. So instead of the area of the event horizon being 4 pi r plus squared, it's 4 pi times r plus squared plus a squared. So it's almost the same, but we just got a little bit of a correction to the area. So for the temperature, I'm going to do notionally the same thing as we did for Schwarzschild. I'm going to take the top line now of the metric. I'm going to look as r goes to r plus and ask that it's regular. The only slightly snaggy thing is that I've got this dt minus a sine squared theta d phi. So what I really want to do is I want to go towards the horizon while not having any contribution from the second line of the metric. So in other words, d theta has to be zero, so I'm coming in at a constant theta line, but I also want to come in sort of at a constant, not quite phi line, but I want to come in at phi equals at divided by r squared plus a squared. So this second element is zero. So that's what I'm going to do, and I'm going to do the same process of asking that my event horizon is non-singular. So here, my ds squared of the sort of horizon part . So this is what I'm getting. Now, if I look at what multiplies this dt squared here, this is r plus squared plus a squared minus a squared sine squared theta. So that's a squared cos squared theta divided by r plus squared plus a squared. Now, this r plus squared plus a squared cos squared theta is nothing other than that sigma, so you'll have to track back to find sigma and delta. But if I multiply this out, what I get is sigma into delta dt squared plus dr squared over delta divided by r plus squared plus a squared all squared. Yes, I'm just doing, I'm using the same method. I'm not taking my time to give you every single step. I'm asking that this be regular. There's a little bit of something I'm glossing over about A, but it's not actually that important for this calculation. So as before, I'm going to take the square root of my radial coordinate, and I'm looking really for a proper distance out from the horizon. So I'm looking at rho squared as lambda r minus r plus, and I'm going to evaluate lambda by insisting that the radial part of this distance just be d rho squared. So here, the radial part of my distance is dr squared over delta, so this is the bit I'm looking at here, which is 4 rho squared d rho squared divided by lambda squared, and my delta, as I go to r equals r plus, delta goes to 0, and so I simply take delta primed r minus r plus. But then lambda times r minus r plus is rho squared, so I can cancel off that rho squared with one of the lambdas and the r minus r plus, and so that tells me my constant lambda is 4 over delta plus primed. Now, delta was r squared plus a squared minus 2gmr, so delta plus primed is 2r plus minus gm. So finally, in order to identify what my temperature is, I have to look at the TT part of that metric. So GTT, which is delta over r plus squared plus a squared, all squared, goes like delta primed r minus r plus over r plus squared plus a squared, all squared. And then my r minus r plus is rho squared on lambda, which is rho squared times delta plus prime squared over 4. So if I want to have a regular horizon, I have to have my time as an angular coordinate, and my angular coordinate, theta or whatever, is tau times this delta plus prime over 2r plus squared plus a squared. So that tells me my inverse temperature is given by this particular combination. So that's what I've got by doing the same steps as the Schwarzschild black hole, but with a bit more effort because we've got rotation. And I had to think a little bit about how to Euclideanize, you know, the time and to look at what happens as you go to the event horizon. So now I'd like to explore whether this is actually reasonable by considering processes in which the black hole changes. So in other words, Bekenstein originally argued that the black hole had entropy by imagining that you threw matter into the black hole. Entropy had to increase. We know that if we throw mass into a black hole, its event horizon area increases, hence this identification of area with entropy. So the intuition actually didn't start from Euclidean approaches, and it didn't start from sort of thinking about regularity of event horizons. It started by thinking about just the black hole solution itself and what happened if you threw something into a black hole. How did it change? I mean, obviously, the intermediate process is messy, but initially you've got a black hole of mass m, and at the end you've got a black hole of mass m plus delta m. So we're going to just look at the Kerr solution, and we're going to imagine that we perturb it by throwing something into it so we can, in principle, change its mass and its angular momentum. So I'm going to need the expression for the event horizon radius of the Kerr black hole, which is given by the root of that delta function. So delta is a quadratic in R, and it's easy to solve. I need the biggest root, which is this one here, gm plus the square root of gm squared minus a squared. So let me ask, what happens if I throw something into a black hole? And I'm going to look at what happens to the area of the black hole. So if I throw something into the black hole, the area can change. And if the area changes, then it's the area is 4 pi times r plus squared plus a squared. So the change in area is 8 pi r plus delta r plus a delta a. Now I'm going to replace delta r plus using this expression for delta r plus. I'm just going to get rid of those 8 pi's. So now I've got an expression for the variation of the area in terms of the mass and the angular momentum parameter A. So we're getting somewhere. We can at least see the impact of adding a little bit of mass. But at the moment, we've just got the variation of the parameter in the solution, A, not the physical quantities. But if you remember, when I introduced the Kerr metric, I said A was equal to J over M. So it's like an angular rotation parameter. But now I want to... Really, I want, if I'm thinking about how things vary, I need to know how they vary if I throw some mass in and if I know what the angular momentum is of whatever I'm throwing in. So I need to have things in terms of J rather than A. So my final step is to input the variation of the A parameter. So now what I have, I've kind of added in these extra pieces here, which notionally cancel, but what I'm trying to do is to move towards an expression that we can recognize. If I look at what pre-multiplies the delta M by substituting in for delta A, I sort of see this combination of R plus squared plus A squared divided by R plus minus GM, which crops up over here. So this is equal to beta, and beta is equal to 1 over T. So this first term is G delta M over 2 pi T. Now the second term, I've also isolated one over t in that. And then what remains is this quantity A over R plus squared plus A squared, which I'm going to call omega. So omega is the angular velocity of the horizon. And you get it by looking at the cross term, the T phi cross term, compared to the G phi phi cross term in the metric. So you can kind of see that from the top board. If you go to R plus, the top line freezes out, and what you're left is with that relation on the bottom line that you've got the essentially phi is AT over R plus squared plus A squared. So that's your angular velocity sort of right up at the top there, in the middle. So if I now replace these quantities, my A with S...
Wouldn't be able to just vary the Bekenstein area formula, the Hawking temperature and A, I mean... A depend on T and M?
Yes.
We could variate T and M?
Yeah, but I don't want to vary T. You're about to see why. So, So if I replace now the area with the entropy, then what I've now got, sort of rearranging everything, is something that is actually recognizable as the first law of thermodynamics. So in our first law of thermodynamics, we have a relation between the variation of the internal energy of a system, its change in entropy. Usually we have a PdV term. And then we, if we have various charges, we have extra pieces like mu dQ, where mu is your chemical potential. So here, J is a charge. It's a conserved quantity, the angular momentum. And this is its corresponding potential. So we recognize this variation, throwing a particle into the black hole, sort of massaging the various terms we get, and then reinterpreting them using our sort of insight from calculating these thermodynamic quantities, we end up with a first law of thermodynamics. So our black holes completely obey the laws of thermodynamics, provided we correctly identify thermodynamic variables associated to the black hole. So that was basically the situation for quite some time after Gibbons and Hawking had sort of redone and reimagined, as they say, the black hole, thinking about different way of finding temperature and entropy. We kind of felt we understood the laws of thermodynamics of black holes. But people always kind of looked at this little term in here, and does that actually have a meaningful interpretation in the context of a black hole? So V is sort of a volume. Well, okay, that makes sense. We know what volumes are. But what could we associate with P? So that's kind of the next thing that I just want to discuss, because really that's only been sort of convincingly worked out sort of within the past few years. And of course, your very own special Psi tutor is an expert in this and one of the people that's been developing this particular aspect of black hole thermodynamics. So before I actually talk about the black hole thermodynamics, I need to discuss what happens to a black hole in the presence of a cosmological constant. So when I talked about the Schwarzschild black hole and first derived it, I calculated the curvature of a metric, spherically symmetric metric, and argued that the radial component of the metric was given by a particularly simple integral. And that was how we came to the interpretation of M as being the mass of the black hole. Now, if I have lambda, then 8 pi g t mu nu is equal to lambda G mean U. So here I would have 1 minus 1 over R integral lambda R squared dr. So I can use my relation for the metric with a cosmological constant, and I find a solution which has GTT as 1 over minus GRR, and it's just like Schwarzschild, except it's modified. It's got an R squared piece in it. So black holes with a cosmological constant are quite important, so I'm just going to say a bit about them. So if lambda is positive, we call this De Sitter space, or DS for short, and we see if lambda's positive, when R is close to 2gm, it's not quite, it's shifted a little bit, but you see there's a zero at small r, and then there's going to be a zero at large r, where r is roughly 1 over root lambda. So I'm assuming here that lambda is, do I mean small? I'm suddenly, yes, lambda is small. So we still have a black hole horizon, but we now get an additional horizon, and we call this the cosmological event horizon. So you'll be seeing this in the context of cosmology. De Sitter space is kind of an important sort of canonical exact solution in cosmology that describes the very early universe and, in fact, the late universe as well. So notice that there's a cosmological horizon. Even when M vanishes. So even if there's no black hole, you still have a horizon in these coordinates. Now, De Sitter's kind of interesting. It's a constant curvature space. It's almost maximally symmetric. And it has many sort of several coordinate systems. So here, this is what we would call a static coordinate system. So I'm encoding the cosmological constant in a mass scale there, K. It also has a global coordinate system. So the static coordinate system has horizons. It's got a coordinate singularity. It's limited by r going to 1 over k. The global coordinate system fully covers De Sitter space. And then there's a coordinate system in which the spatial sections look flat, and that's probably what you're going to see when you do the inflationary universe in cosmology. So you have an exponential prefactor to your spatial sections, and this is our flat universe. Now, they're all the same manifold, they're just different coordinatizations, and De Sitter can actually be represented as a submanifold of flat five-dimensional space. So it looks like a hyperboloid. And so the global coordinate system's kind of easy to see here. T sort of runs up the picture, and these S3s are just the constant T sections of this hyperboloid. So that one's kind of easy to see. This one's slightly more sort of complicated. It's kind of a slicing whereby you sort of take the interior light cone and your sort of constant, I think this is right, your constant, your spatial sections are now open. Now, the funny thing is, I know exactly what the static basis is if I Euclideanize De Sitter, and I'm blanking a bit on what it is. If it's, I think you take just half of the hyperboloid, and that's what the static coordinate system is. So the Penrose diagram, kind of looks like a square for De Sitter. So this would be sort of T is plus infinity, T is minus infinity. Kind of these things represent the horizons. And then for Schwarzschild De Sitter, your Schwarzschild piece looks like the Schwarzschild Penrose diagram. Then you have an additional cosmological event horizon. And then the whole thing kind of repeats. You carry on maximally analytically extending across both the cosmological and the event horizons. And so the space, the maximally analytically extended space, just keeps going.
What is the multiple horizontal line?
Sorry? That's just T, that's this one here. It's just a sort of, you know, that is your past time-like infinity. So for Minkowski space, past time-like infinity was a point, so to speak, of our Penrose diagram. Here, past time-like infinity is space-like. I don't pretend that this is obvious, okay? You have to kind of just, I'm just showing it to you. Now, another important space-time is where the cosmological constant is negative. So this crops up in a massive branch of string theory known as the gauge gravity correspondence, or holography. So I can't get away without mentioning anti-De Sitter space. And in this case, our metric can be written in this way. And because lambda is negative, I don't actually need that one in the metric in order to make my my GTT regular. So here, our obvious solution is to take kappa equals 1, in which case my dx squared is d omega 2. and my black hole is spherical. But with anti-de Sitter space, it's actually weird. We can get a planar black hole. And we can also get a hyperbolic black hole. Because in all of those three cases, R equals zero, which is the singularity, is shielded by an event horizon, which is a zero of GTT. So in other words, horizons can have different topologies. So this is something that's rather different about anti-de Sitter space. My spherical black hole So if I have a planar black hole, there's just one horizon. Which the radius is sort of at a balance between the length scale given by the mass of the black hole and the length scale given by the cosmological constant. It's obviously a little different if we've got a spherical black hole because we've got that extra term in this function f. So it's the root of a cubic. And our Penrose diagram again, we've got the horizon structure of Schwarzschild, but now what anti-de Sitter has is a time-like boundary. So there's sort of similarities and differences between de Sitter and anti-de Sitter. So I want to now very quickly at the end, go back to these thermodynamic arguments, but do this same process that we did for Kerr, however, with the cosmological constant. So that's my potential, GTT. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to consider what happens if I throw a little bit of matter into the black hole. My event horizon is defined by the zero of F. So if I throw some matter into the black hole, I might expect R plus to change, or indeed if I do any variation on my black hole, I might expect the horizon radius to change. So I'm going to look at delta of F of R plus, which should be zero. So that would be if I'm completely, you know, unprejudiced and say, what happens if I vary the parameters of my solution? I vary R plus, I shift the event horizon, I vary M, and I can vary L. So that's my sort of perspective. Now, as before, if I go through exactly the same arguments to find out the regularity of the Euclidean section, I get my temperature. So remember, We saw this coming up last time as a derivative of delta, so this is where this is coming from. And my entropy should be proportional to R plus squared. So if I recall my first law of thermodynamics, and I vary entropy, T delta S, well, delta S is going to give me a delta R plus. My T gives me an F plus primed. And then you can see I've got this combination F plus prime delta R plus, which crops up over here. So that's equal to 2G delta M on R plus, plus 2R plus squared on L cubed delta L. So I rearrange. And what I see is I've got delta M as T delta S again. I mean, that's what we just got when we looked at Kerr. But now, if I allow my cosmological constant to vary, I've got a second term. And I've kind of grouped it together suggestively, because what I've done here is I've got V, a volume inside a sort of geometric volume, inside the event horizon. And then if I think, what is this? Well, my T, say if I pick one of the angular coordinates, so my T theta theta, which is lambda minus lambda over 8 pi g, is actually, so I should have a 3 in the top there, shouldn't I? Is actually equal to 3 over 8 pi g L squared. So this term here, I could assign as being a pressure term, thermodynamic pressure. So now I've got delta M is T delta S plus V delta P. So this is indeed a first law of thermodynamics, but the only thing is, it's not, M is now no longer the internal energy. So here's my du is Tds minus Pdv. Instead, it's actually, hang on, let me. But now, rather than associating M with U, I want to associate M with U plus PV, which is the enthalpy. So it's M, which for Schwarzschild, for many years, we thought M was just the internal energy of the black hole. It seems that the more correct interpretation of M is the enthalpy of the black hole. So I strongly encourage you to ask David more about this, because he's an expert. And I also think David has quite a nice tutorial on black holes in ADS planned at some point. Yeah, there's lots of interesting thermodynamics in ADS. So, okay, I don't believe, I must have raced through this or something, because I never thought I'd get through all this.